From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today on the program, we continue our documentary series with a film about the Five Browns. Five siblings, piano prodigies, all of them, from a Utah family who became an international performing sensation. And then, right at the height of their popularity, the story breaks that their father had been sexually abusing the daughters. The film is about how they tried to contain the story and how music helped them heal. We'll be right back.
On the Next More to Say, we're picking up on a conversation we started last week about affordable housing in Utah. This is part of KUER's Hive Mind project, where you ask our reporters questions and they try to find the answers. This time, it's all about tiny homes. Maybe you've seen them on Instagram, those beautifully apportioned, incredibly small houses. People go nuts for this stuff. Things get complicated, though, for one couple when a nosy neighbor spots their tiny home in a friend's backyard. Download The Next More to Say, available now wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. On May 14th of 2011, Keith and Lisa Brown were driving down Little Cottonwood Canyon when their car careened over a cliff. They were fine, but as the story unfolded, the truly explosive news broke. Keith Brown, the patriarch and manager of the Five Browns, that's the incredibly talented piano-playing siblings who had become this international performing sensation, he had been charged with sexually abusing his three daughters. It was a stunning revelation, a kind of surreal twist that really shattered this facade about the Brown family. They seemed kind of perfect, straight-laced, devout Mormons, beautiful kids, doting parents, and just brilliant musicians. But the car accident blew open this dark secret, and the Five Browns had to decide what to do next. A new documentary film explores the questions they were working through, how you deal with the abuse, the effect that it's going to have on their relationships, their careers, their music. The film is called Digging Through the Darkness, and we're going to be screening it as part of our documentary series next Wednesday night. Today in the program, we're talking with Benjamin Niles, who produced and directed the film. He joined us recently from a studio at Montclair State University in New Jersey. How much did you know about the Five Browns and the story behind this when you first started? Like, what did you know about all of this at first?
I knew of them as classical pianists. I'd heard of them many, many years earlier when I was working on a film that follows the making of a Steinway called Note by Note. And somebody said, you should put the Five Browns in your movie. And I said, how can I put five people in my movie? But so I did know about them musically. And then years later, I did hear about the abuse when it came out in the press. I guess that would have been 2011 or 10 or 11. So that's kind of all I knew. And so when Steinway actually asked me to film a little mini concert that the Five Browns were giving for the craftsmen at the Steinway factory, I was really excited to meet them. But I had no idea that the story itself was sort of still moving forward. And so, you know, quite honestly, I wasn't that interested in pursuing a film because I just didn't see the point. I didn't think they would be interested. I didn't see that any reason to, you know, subject them to having to talk about all this stuff again. As we talked and I learned more about them, I realized that there was so much more to this and so much more happening in the present.
Yeah. It's interesting. I think for a lot of us, it seems so obvious that the film would be about their harrowing experience with the sexual abuse of their father. But it seems like that in some ways, maybe that wasn't always a given for you, that this could be a little bit about that, but maybe about something else, their music maybe more.
Oh, yeah. I mean, again, you know, I didn't have any interest in just telling, you know, a rehash of everything that they had said in the press, which was fairly minimal, but still it was out there. And neither did they, quite frankly. But when, again, when they started telling me more about what they were doing, so I quickly learned that Desiree and Deandra Brown had put together a foundation called the Foundation for Survivors of Abuse, because they wanted to reform statute of limitation laws in the United States. They would not have been able to prosecute their father had the statute of limitation laws not been changed in Utah. And in fact, they were one of them was unable to, I think, bring charges against their father in the state of New York because the state of New York has terrible statute of limitation laws. But on top of that, which I found really compelling, they're Desiree and Deandra are advocates, and they're working with Senator Kirsten Gillibrand on this bill to reform the statute of limitations. I found that compelling in itself. But then they told me about this new record that they were working on called the Little Tin Box. And I said, well, what's the significance of this record? And they said, well, this is music that we played as children.
Yeah.
So it's really a reflection of our childhood. And as soon as they told me that, I thought, well, this is kind of perfect because the music in the film is going to mirror the stories you're telling about your childhood. And at the same time, the music is part of this healing process that they're going through.
Hmm.
So that's, I think, when it started to work for me. And then the big question, I think, on their part was, so is this going to be like 80% abuse and 20% music?
Yeah.
Or how do you see this?
Yeah.
And they just had to trust me because I couldn't really quantify it. But I, in my mind, I really did want to balance it because there's so much more to them than what happened in their childhood. They're doing so much more outside of that.
Yeah. Melody says in the film that the reason she's doing the documentary in the first place is she doesn't want to have to talk about this anymore. But I wonder, did all of them express something like that reticence to that they weren't sure they wanted to get this out in the open, or maybe they did, and maybe this was the way to move on. And if we just say this thing about it, if there's this documentary film that says this, then we can stop talking about it and move on to something else.
Yeah, that's a great question. Melody was certainly the most vocal in terms of, you know, just really being upfront with me.
Yeah.
Before I would turn the camera on. But and the others, I don't recall any of the others saying anything prior to the interviews. However, I think especially early on, I'm going to guess that they were talking to each other a lot about what questions did he ask you, because I did all these interviews in their own homes. So there was never anyone else in the room. There, not a brother or sister. But no, there wasn't a lot of pushback. And, you know, what's really interesting is, as reluctant as Melody might have been, at least initially, to talk about some things, she was the one who was really pushing the group to be as natural as possible. Mm-hmm. And if we're going to do this, we're gonna do it right. You know, we're not going to not fight in front of Ben. We're not going to, you know, change the way we act with each other. All of that stuff has to stay the same. And so she was the one who was really driving that. So it's kind of interesting that she was the one.
Well, you know, I one of the things that struck me about the film is that it seems like all of those five Browns are sick and tired of just smiling absently in front of a camera, like putting on the brave face. Like, that's not who they are if they're going to tell this truth. It seems like they're just tired of that, and they want to be real and authentic for a moment, it seems.
Yeah, and I couldn't agree more. And you couldn't find five more real people, if you will.
Yeah,
I mean, but you know, there was a certain amount of I don't know. They were sort of this, you know, the poster children, if you will, of classical music.
Yeah.
You know, when they came out, and everything was super wholesome. And you know, there's even a scene in the film where, you know, Melody says, "Well, but you know, we got to do the faces."
Yep.
And they're so tired. They're like, "Oh God, but we've been playing all day, and now we got to play again, and I don't feel like doing the faces." And then after everything came out with their father, and they did this record, "The Rite of Spring," which was what they called their angst album. You know, that whole facade kind of just fell down. And like Desiree said, you know, when I go out on stage now, I have nothing to hide.
Right.
And I think, I think they would agree that musically they're in a very, very different place than where they were before.
Yeah.
You know, those notes are all the same, and they're still, and indeed they were pouring their hearts out when they were performing, say before 2007. But yes, they're very different artists now, as you might imagine any artist,
right,
when they've had something traumatic like that happen.
Yeah. I have to say, one of the questions that came up for me in the film is how much of their passion for music and their commitment to music, you know, was driven by their parents, and then how much of that came from within. And then because of what had happened with their parents, the abuse of their father, the kind of their mother looking the other way, or being ambivalent about it, how much of that ruined the experience of music for them?
Yeah, that's a great question. Well, I think two things. I think, again, when they did The Rite of Spring, that was the first record they had done without their father as their manager. He was now in prison. They had broke ties with their mother, and it is somewhat angry music, and they were really able to pour themselves into that, and I think it was extremely cathartic for them. But as Gregory points out, you know, sometimes anger can be really positive when you've had a traumatic experience like this. But they got to a stage where they thought, you know what, let's try to do something that's a little more optimistic. And we did have some nice childhood moments, and it's not all bad. So I think that was the impetus for The Little Tin Box and this music that sort of, you know, mirrored their childhood. So, you know, they're really, I think they're really inspiring people on a bunch of levels. But I mean, especially for people who've had to deal with abuse or again, anything traumatic, you know, I think they really show you that you can go through the anger, but you can also come out on the other side and sort of cherry pick the past, if you will, and, you know, see the brighter side of things. Now, that being said, I think they would be quick to point out that they'll be healing forever, right? I mean, when people have these types of things happen, it doesn't just get better at set number of years or whatever. So, you know, they're still dealing with some of that. You know, Desiree's got her eye issues in her left eye, and I think there's been some chronic illnesses here and there, but I think for the most part they're in a very good place right now.
Let's back up a little bit and just talk about some of the things that you explore early in the film as a kind of way of setting the table for what happens. And that is, we have to, as you explain in the film, I mean, they blew up when the New York Times published this article about them. And then they were everywhere. I think most people probably know that from that time, around 2007 or so. They were everywhere, and they were huge, and they traveled the world. And then the role of their parents comes up in the film, just as at one point in the film there are these questions about how their parents were controlling and possibly even exploiting them, and, you know, more focused on their careers than giving them a real childhood or an authentic, you know, family experience. So let me play a moment from the film. We're going to hear from Desiree and Melody and Gregory and Deandra talking about, this was, I think, when they were in Japan. Mm-hmm. And it was just becoming too much.
There was a lot of conflict from the time the five of us started performing together. My mom wanted to pick the repertoire. My dad was pushing us to do more concerts than we were comfortable with. I think the first year we were performing, we did 130 concerts. We play a concert and then wake up at 3 a.m. to catch a flight the next morning to go play another concert, and then wake up at 3 a.m. and catch another plane to go play another concert. I don't even remember. It was just such a blur.
All of us considered quitting at one point.
This is the first year of my marriage. I would call my husband just in tears, wondering if I should come home. The music wasn't even fun anymore.
What can you say about that, Benjamin, about this part? Because this really gets to, I guess, frankly, the questionable motives, maybe, of their parents.
Well, let me point out this, though, that, you know, Melody was asked in the 60 Minutes interview in 2001 if this was their parents' vision. And she said, you know, when we were younger, it was our mother's goal. But at a certain point, it became our goal. And I think that's true. I think that, you know, they were driven, for sure, by their parents. But I do think that there was a genuine love for the piano and a desire to play. I think Ryan was the only one who was a little more ambivalent about playing. But yes, when they started to tour, I think their parents did see an opportunity. And they were, you know, their father was overscheduling them. And they became really frustrated. You know, as Deandra said in the film, you know, I felt trapped.
Yeah.
You know, her father would add things to the schedule without telling them, and then tell them at the last minute when they couldn't be changed. And they were just physically exhausted because they were having to do all these special events and outreach and go to schools and then turn around and play a concert that night. So, but you know what's interesting about that scene you just played is that Japan tour was really pivotal, because it was just 4 or 5 weeks later, when they were in Washington, D.C., that Desiree and Deandra had that fateful conversation, and it was revealed among the sisters for the first time that they had been sexually abused.
Yeah.
So when I look at that footage from the Japan tour, I think, man, it really was about to come crumbling down.
Right before that moment, I want to play a section from the film In Japan, or at least a reference to what was going on there, because Melody talks about in the film how that Desiree is noticing something is off. Something is spiritually off. That's how she puts it about her father. Let me play this, and I want to talk a little bit about it. Again, this is Melody.
Mm-hmm. I remember when Desi first talked to me. She's like, I hate to say this, but, like, he's spiritually off. She's like, I feel like he's abusing his authority. You know, is this the first time he's abused his authority? Should I be trusting my intuition that something's off? That maybe there's more to this, this, you know, what seemed like a superficial thing of all this arguing in this Japanese tour. Is there more that's underlying between Deandra and my dad?
I think this is a really interesting moment. Even before the great reveal comes between the two sisters, that they're starting to, they know something is going on to them. And you know, should they trust their intuition? Do they dare say anything? I really liked this part of the film because we get an inkling that they're really working it out before they dare say anything at all.
Right. Yeah, and they were. And, you know, it's interesting to hear it put like he's spiritually off.
Yep.
Like, he was indeed, he was spiritually off. But, see, he was trying to again, going back to this scheduling that they keep referring to, you know, he had them going into these hospitals and churches and schools. And like Deandra said, you know, you can't undo all the bad things you've done in your life by just doing a bunch of good things on top of it, you know. And that was my perception of what he was trying to do. And yeah, I mean, Deandra would have to speak more to this, but the pressure that he was putting on them and the way he was controlling their lives, yeah, she was inching closer and closer to finally opening up to her big sister and revealing the secret.
I wanted to ask you that question of being spiritually off raises the question of what part the Browns' Mormonism play in this story and the way you were thinking about that for the film. It doesn't play a large role, quite frankly. I mean, the question of spirituality comes up briefly. We see them praying from time to time, performing in churches. There's a reference to a Mormon temple wedding, which we can get back to, but not much more than that. So I'm wondering how you were thinking about that, the part of that Mormonism played in the story.
You know, I thought about it for sure, but I didn't see that the Mormonism played a major role in terms of the way he acted towards his daughters and the way they responded.
Yeah.
We did discuss this in some of the interviews. They had initially, when they were trying to save the family, they had gone to the church elders and had, you know, tried to talk this through. But I just didn't, in the end, it just felt like when you, like, tapping into the whole religious aspect of something like this, it just felt like another film. And at the same time, there wasn't that much to it. And so I felt like the references that are there to the church and the fact that we do show them praying before the concerts and for me was enough.
So it's a few weeks after this tour, this tumultuous tour in Japan, when the dam breaks, basically. And as Deandra says in the film, this is the fall of 2007, we should point out. They're in the middle of this concert tour and and Deandra and Desiree happened to be sharing a room, and let me play this moment from the film.
This was a few weeks after Japan. For some reason, Deandra and I were sharing a room. I had just kind of been piecing things together in my mind, and I just asked her into the darkness as straight up if Dad had abused her. And it was the worst moment of my life to hear the answer. We realized that we had both been sexually abused by my father and had never told a soul about it. And we suspected that if the two of us had been abused, that our younger sister, Melody, had also, and we were correct when we approached her the next day.
Benjamin, let me ask you the extent of the abuse. What did you learn about that? What are we talking about in terms of the abuse? I mean, it's explicit in some ways in the film expressed, but you also get a kind of reticence about them wanting to be terribly specific about it. I mean, what can you say about it? Because you also talk about in the film, or they do, what kind of an abuser he was, but what are we talking about in terms of the extent of the abuse?
Well, specifically, I don't know.
Yeah.
That's something that I never asked. And the reason being was, well, for a long time I thought, do I need to know?
Right.
and I really wrestled with that. And, you know, I would talk to friends and film and stuff like that, and they'd say, oh, no, you should try to get more specifics. And I thought Desiree's answer, you know, there were thousands of instances, several hundred qualifies rape of a child. Well, I thought, well, if people need to hear more than that, then this isn't the film for them.
Yeah.
But I was talking to Deandra one day, and she said, you know, one of the things that means so much to me is that my brothers have never asked us what happened. And she said, I so appreciate that because, you know, a lot of survivors of abuse are not believed. And she said, you know, it didn't matter to them. They didn't need to hear that. And they never asked us, and we've never told them. And I thought, well, if Ryan and Gregory have never asked and they've never had that discussion, then far be it from me to ask that question. So
I think it's such an interesting dilemma for a filmmaker. And I like where you came down. You know, the question is whether it's truly necessary to get really specific about that to reveal the truth of this story. And it just doesn't seem like it is. We get the point, you know?
Yeah, I mean, you bring up a really good point. I mean, from a filmmaking point of view, let's be honest. I mean, conflict, the more conflict, the more drama, equals more interest a lot of times. And I just really felt like there was already a lot of that, and that there was more to the story that was also equally dramatic and inspiring and fun to watch at times. I mean, it's funny when people see the film, they say, gosh, I thought that was going to be such a downer, but it found it to be so joyful and uplifting. And so, yeah, I think I was trying to strike that balance, and I have to stop and give credit to my editor, Amanda Larson, who, was really masterful in her editing to help strike that balance.
It seems almost unthinkable now, but you explore in the film this attempt that they made early on after all of this to move on, you know, altogether. And as Desiree says, they wanted to salvage their relationship with their father if they could. Let me play another moment from the film. This is Melody and Deandra. Let me play that moment here.
We were so tight, you know? We were so tight as a family that, like, we couldn't just give up on that. When things first came out and he took responsibility for it and he owned up to it and, you know, we sort of had these sort of interventions that, you know, my mom actually headed up the first couple and he apologized to all of us and our spouses and our crying and tears involved and hugs, and it was going well. It was going really, really well. We did everything that we could think of, the five of us, to keep our family together. We went above and beyond and tried everything and then tried it again. But it's also like when we started seeing a counselor, I mean, he realized right off, he's like, there's a lot of enmeshment here. Like, you can't separate the business from the family, from the abuse, from, like, it's just all in this weird little thing wrapped up together. He's like, you do realize that if you can't work things out with your parents, he's like, it's going to be something that you think about for the rest of your life.
We have to talk about the reaction of the Browns' parents, Lisa and Keith Brown. How did you manage an interview with Lisa, first of all? And these are the strangest moments of the film, I have to say. I just think she seems so clueless, I'll be honest. And they're very odd. They seem off key. she doesn't seem to be really addressing the reality of the situation. And I don't know, would you just talk a little bit about, first of all, approaching Lisa and then the conversations you were having with her?
Yeah, well, so this is I find this really interesting from a filmmaking point of view as well. When I approached, well, first of all, me and the Five Browns, we talked initially, like, would I want to interview Keith or Lisa?
Yeah.
And at first I said, I don't know. I don't know if it's necessary. As time went on, I thought, you know, I should definitely interview Lisa. People I was telling, you know, talking to about the film were asking about the mom. Everybody was asking, well, what about the mom? So I thought, well, I better do this. And Lisa and I tiptoed around it quite a bit via email and phone conversations. And then about 2 days before I was supposed to interview her, she, to her credit, she called me and said, look, I just want to know, are you going to ask me questions about my husband's incarceration? And I said, yeah, I do intend on asking you. I mean, that's part of this story. Yeah. And she said, well, I don't want to talk about it. So I thought, well, I'm a documentary filmmaker and, you know, I'm not going to, we won't do the interview.
Right.
Because I've got, you know, standards. And but then several months went by and I thought, you know what? Let's just do the interview and leave the elephant in the room and see what happens. And so I agreed to do the interview without asking any questions about her incarceration or the abuse.
That's so interesting.
Yeah. And
I don't know how I feel about that. I have to say, Benjamin, on some level, it makes absolute sense because what you got was incredibly revealing.
Well, let me tell you why I came to this decision. I was listening to an interview with another filmmaker, and her film was getting rave reviews. And but the interview was on NPR or something, and said, "Well, you're getting a little bit of flack for not interviewing the police officers." It doesn't matter what the film is. It's just there were police involved.
Yeah.
And she said, well, yeah, you know, I did interview the police officers, but they were just giving me the kind of company line, you know, and I didn't feel like it was authentic. And I thought, well, that's a shame that she didn't see an opportunity to put one or two of these police officers in her movie. And wouldn't the audience just see through that? And that's when I thought, yeah, I'll interview Lisa because they will see through it. And I'm not going to need to ask her about the abuse. I mean, it speaks volumes that she doesn't want to talk about it.
Yeah.
So I hear where you're coming from, but it wasn't a decision I made lightly, and it wasn't a decision I made quickly. This was pretty late in production when I finally decided to do this interview. And then to have, you know, Keith call during the interview was just, you know, kind of off the charts.
Yeah, here's that moment.
I'm happy for them. Everything they do. And if I'm included, great. If I'm not, fine again. And I just, they're like, Mom, you need a life. And I'm like, they told me that once they got to the school. And I'm like, I guess so, because, you know, what do you do with a mom that sat at the piano for 8 hours a day? It's like, oh, house cleaning and cooking, and, you know, I did all that. This is Keith. Hello?
This is a prepaid call from
Keith,
an inmate at the Utah State Department of Corrections.
Hey, how are you doing? Oh, I'm in an interview right now, but that's okay. Yeah. Well, do you have any questions you want to ask him?
Benjamin, what were you thinking right there? That is crazy. that happened.
I'll tell you what I was thinking. I looked right over at the camera, and I was thinking, that red light better be on.
Amazing.
It was kind of amazing that Keith called in from the prison. In retrospect, I'm not totally surprised, and I don't think any of the five Browns were either. Hmm. I think they are in very close contact with one another, Lisa and Keith. I think he calls her a lot. Apparently, he calls her more than most inmates are allowed, but I don't know any more than that. Yes, I was surprised, but I think he is still manipulating her, and he's doing it from prison. At least that's my opinion. When he called in, he didn't just call in once. I mean, you know, he kept getting bumped off because, I guess they only have, 15 minutes or something from the prison? So, yeah. Yeah. I mean, this... He called in several times after that. It was interesting for sure. And I had not planned on interviewing him in prison. That was something that I really just didn't feel like giving him a voice in this film. Mm-hmm. But under these circumstances, it was a little different.
Yeah. That's Benjamin Niles. He produced and directed the film Digging Through the Darkness. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West from KUER.
KUER teams up with local and national businesses around the state to support the station and bring you Utah stories and national news from NPR. If you've got a business, like a restaurant or a car repair shop, or maybe you take wedding photos or offer legal services, whatever it is, when you join KUER as a business sponsor, you're helping people who care deeply about facts and storytelling stay connected to their community, all while building your company's brand. Learn more about becoming a sponsor at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now to our conversation with Benjamin Niles. He's a documentary filmmaker. We're talking about the film Digging Through the Darkness. It's about the five Browns. I want to ask you, the film is also an exploration of how an abuse victim experiences this. You know, what it is that they repress, what it is they reveal, how they go about that process, you know, when and how they remember what happened. And I wanted you to talk a little bit about this video that Melody makes, because it's really all about that. What is the stuff from your past that you trash, and what is the stuff from your past that you keep? Talk a little bit about that, because it almost becomes a bit of a theme in the film, it seems.
Yeah. So Melody does all the directing for the group. They've made some wonderful music videos, which I encourage people to check out. Yeah. But she made this music video for one of the pieces from the Rite of Spring. Again, their angst record that they made. And... it was a very cathartic process for her. You know, the concept was that you see this landfill on the outskirts of Salt Lake City, and she's realizing like real people have trashed. You know, there's a teddy bear, there's a portrait of a family, and she's feeling the same way. She's trying to sort of cleanse herself, if you will, from this abuse by, you know, purging some of her belongings. And she finds these old letters and cards that they used to write to each other as children. And she's realizing, wait a second, am I going to trash this? So that was the concept for that video. And again, I think it was, you know, by her own account, it was a very cathartic experience for her to make that video. And it ultimately comes full circle when you think about this new record, The Little Tin Box, that, again, is a mirror of their the music they played as children. So they, as she puts it, you know, is it trash or is it keep? And so I think they're trying to determine, okay, what do I want to keep from that childhood, right? Because it wasn't all bad. But she had to go through that process, through the Rite of Spring and that music, to sort of get through to the other side, I guess, and be able to keep things and hold on to things.
Here's Melody again from the film.
You don't realize it's there, the abuse and everything. For me, it literally hit me when I was looking in a mirror before going off to school one day to Juilliard. I just remember looking in the mirror and it just hit, like, out of nowhere. You have no control over it. And then you start digging. You start digging through these layers upon layers of memory. And as you start digging, it starts to become very real what happened to you.
We should say that music is incredibly important in the film, not only in the life that they do, but in the aesthetic presentation, in the stylistic presentation. Talk a little bit about that. I guess it's obvious that we would be hearing a lot of piano music, but it's not just them playing. It's also as accompanying, and as you say, the Rite of Spring and some of the other music that they're preparing for this new album, and that's a catharsis for them. It's this whole film is bound up in this idea of music, it seems.
Yeah, well, that's really been the foundation for what has kept them normal, if you will, as Melody says. And Deandra points out that, you know, through all these years when they were constantly at the piano playing music, you know, the music was probably helping to heal parts of their brain. Yeah. I mean, not to get into the science of it, but I mean, this is something that certainly has been discussed and written about a lot, is the healing power of music. So there's certainly that. And I think, you know, when you think about trying to put myself in this place, which is impossible, but, you know, where something like this is happening to you in your childhood, and yet you're being asked to be at the piano for 6 to 8 hours a day.
Yeah.
Well, certainly that practice at the piano, or playing any instrument for that matter, is going to help you sort of compartmentalize, I guess, the abuse, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, to think about it now, I think, well, God, if they hadn't been practicing that much, they might have quit altogether, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, who knows what they'd be like today?
Yeah.
So there's definitely that healing part of it. And then again, to, you know, come out on the other side of that and feel good about playing the music again, and feel different. Like, mm-hmm. you know, when Gregory plays the Schumann, you know, the child falling asleep and pleading child, you know, like Melody said, you know, I heard him playing that growing up. But when he sits at that bench now as an adult, having gone through this with his sisters and losing his parents, et cetera, et cetera, and he informs that music in a very different way now. And so that was something that we wanted to capture, right? Because we see a lot of the archival footage of them playing as children. But when you've had, any musician will tell you, I mean, you know, when you've had experiences in your life, you just invariably become a better musician because you have more to say with that instrument.
When we started thinking about making this album, one of the very first pieces that we decided needed to be on there was Kinderszenen by Robert Schumann, which is basically scenes from childhood. This was a piece that I had played as a young kid. Child falling asleep. I always kind of imagine as sort of after one has cried, right? When I'm playing that, I can't help but think about my sisters. The sadness that sort of comes out of me while I'm playing that is very real. I could have been kinder earlier. I could have been warmer and, like, you know, taken their pulse a little bit more. When you're hurting and in pain, I think the last thing that you need is sort of silence or distance from the people in your lives.
Benjamin, let me ask you this finally. One of the things that I think happens in the film is it kind of makes a turn, seemed to me anyway, at the end, where they're having these creative differences about a Beethoven's fifth piece that they're trying to put together. Mm-hmm. And on one hand, you think, oh no, they're going to break up or they're not getting along like they used to. But it made me think, no, they're becoming more individuals. They're asserting themselves as individual musicians, and I think they can survive as a group, but they're also having to figure this out for themselves, and that seemed like a good thing.
Absolutely. That the Beethoven's Fifth that they were working on, I mean, this was yes, there were a lot of complications, I guess, in recording that, and there was some fighting. And, you know, from my point of view, it did illustrate them acting as individuals, which they very much are now. And I think, you know, they say in the film, like, we just used to make these decisions so easily, and it was always a group thing. And that scene also illustrates what happens among musicians, right?
Yeah.
That it's not always easy, and you're not always going to agree with someone on how to approach a certain piece or something. So, but, you know, I love some of the lines that the producer, Adam Abeshouse, has in the film, because I think they're so prophetic. You know, he says at one point, he says, take all the baggage that came before, and he's talking about music, right? I mean, he's not even making reference to the abuse, but he's like, take all the baggage that came before and just throw it out the window, because you know what? Everything that came before, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter what you did before. That's one line where I thought, gosh, that's so prophetic. And then towards the end, you know, he just kind of put it out there on a platter for me. You know, he said, hey, guys, let's make this about you as five individuals. And I just thought, thank you very much for summing up the movie.
That's Benjamin Niles. His documentary film is called Digging Through the Darkness. He joined us from a studio on the campus of Montclair State University in New Jersey. Radio West is a production of KUER News. We had technical direction from Tim Slover. Our thanks also to Tess Goodwin. The program is produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.